Now, this is our seventh lesson in the series, The Big Story of the Bible. Of course, they haven't been seven consecutive weeks. And we're going to attempt to cover all of Exodus 1 through 15. Now, when I was originally thinking I would be teaching this lesson around this time, I was excited because I was supposed to have studied this passage in great detail for my school. But I'm running hopelessly behind, so I didn't get to do that. So I had to study for the lesson in particular, but hopefully it will still be a blessing. And as with our other lessons, there is no way, there is so much. This is 15 chapters. And when I preach a sermon, I usually preach on two or three verses. And so there is no way whatsoever we're going to cover every detail. And there'll always be things of significance that I didn't cover. But the goal that I'm trying to get at in this course is not always to pick up every detail that's significant in that story itself, but in particular, to emphasize those points that get picked up later on in the big story of the Bible, so that you can see how it fits together. So if you imagine puzzle pieces, how they fit together, then when I'm talking about each puzzle piece, then I'm going to be focusing on the join between that and the puzzle piece that comes after, and setting up so I can do the same thing the next week, even though there's a whole lot on the puzzle piece itself that we're not going to be able to cover. Does that basically make sense? Does that analogy help? Okay. So we're going to sum up in each lesson. Each time we've done this, we've summed up where we've come before to remember those points that we've set up for this lesson in particular. So the big story starts with God's creation of all that is. And the climax of God's creative work was the creation of mankind in God's image and likeness for the purpose of exercising dominion over all the rest of creation. Mankind, of course, failed in this task. And when they did, they were subjected to a threefold curse. First, fulfilling God's command to be fruitful and multiply would only come with pain and sorrow and difficulty. Second, tilling the ground and taking dominion over the earth would only come with labor and difficulty. And third, no longer could the now defiled and rebellious humanity God had made dwell in his presence. Throughout the first 11 chapters of Genesis, we see the ongoing effects of this threefold curse as the rebellion that Adam and Eve had begun spiraled ever more out of control, culminating in the Tower of Babel. Now, I must be brief if we're ever to get to our subject for tonight. That is, after all, why we spent a whole week last night on review. But in the end, God chose Abraham. It is essential that we remember that God's choice of Abraham was not because Abraham was such a wonderful guy that God wanted to do him a favor. God chose Abraham because Abraham and the seed that he promised to give Abraham was and remains God's plan to reverse the effects of the rebellion of humanity and to restore his creation to the purposes for which he originally intended it. When God chose Abraham, he gave him both commands and promises. The promises that God gave to Abraham, reiterated throughout the remainder of Genesis, boil down to three basic promises that show up in various forms throughout his story. A continuous line of direct descendants that would culminate in a mighty nation, a land of their own, and a covenant relationship with God. These promises were, if you notice, a direct reversal of the curse that had fallen on humanity as a result of their rebellion. And it was through the fulfillment of these promises to Abraham that God promised to reverse the rebellion and the consequences of the rebellion of humanity. For his part, Abraham was commanded to go to the land of Canaan and to be a blessing to the nations around him. Yet though Abraham's obedience to these commands was sporadic at best, God continued faithful to his promises. And throughout the rest of Genesis, no matter how badly Abraham and his family messed up, and no matter how impossible the odds may have seemed at times, God did indeed preserve a continuous line of direct descendants to Abraham and his family in accordance with his promise. Yet though this line of descendants was preserved, by the time we get to the end of Genesis, Abraham's seed had not yet become a mighty, by the time we get to the end of Genesis, Abraham's seed had yet to become a mighty nation. It was not in the land of Canaan, and they were not evidencing any particular concern for worshiping God. And this is the setting for the Exodus account. The Exodus account is absolutely foundational to everything else that follows in the big story. While the creation account is the grand presupposition of everything that follows in the Bible as a whole, and the rebellion in the garden explains why God's good creation is in such a mess, And while the call of Abraham reveals God's plan to fix that mess, the book of Exodus reveals what it looks like when God's plan goes into action. More than anything that comes before or after it, it is the language and the imagery of the Exodus account that reverberates throughout the remainder of the big story. God's redemption of his people from Egyptian bondage became a central paradigm that once you begin to look for it, you see it all over the place, on not in every page, but over and over and over again. It's picked up. Well, I keep saying I'm not going to get ahead of myself, so I'm going to stop. But I want to go into a spiel about all the places it gets picked up, but we've got to stick with the story we're at right now. In keeping with the way I'm doing this series, see, I wrote a reminder to myself right here on my notes. We'll not be discussing all of these right now, because if we did, you wouldn't go home. But we'll have cause to return to it over and over and over and over and over and over again as we continue throughout the big story of the Bible. At this point, it is time that we turn to the Exodus account itself, because we have a lot to get through, so we best get started. So please open your Bibles to Exodus 1, and I will be referencing various texts as we go along, and so I'll be mentioning kind of what chapter we're at. No way we can read all of Exodus 1 through 15, but I'll be picking up particular verses. So as I read through the story, and as I work through the story, then flip along so that you're pretty close to where we'll be at, and I'll be mentioning some particular verses as we go through. So I'm going to start with reading the first seven verses. Now these are the names of the children of Israel, which came into Egypt. Every man in his household came with Jacob: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin, Dan, and Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. And all the souls that came out of the loins of Jacob were 70 souls, for Joseph was in Egypt already. And Joseph died, and all his brethren, and all that generation. And here's the crucial verse: and the children of Israel were fruitful, and increased abundantly, and multiplied, and waxed exceeding mighty, and the land was filled with them. Exodus opens with the descendants of Israel in the land of Egypt, where God had brought them in order to preserve a seed from famine. Verse 7 makes clear that God's promise of abundant descendants for Abraham had finally been fulfilled. Furthermore, this fulfilling of God's promise to Abraham fulfilled God's original command to Adam and Eve to be fruitful and multiply. The language in this verse is making a direct connection back to Genesis 1:28. Be fruitful and multiply. God's people were fruitful and multiplying. And that's not the only connection to Genesis chapter 1 in the Exodus account, as we shall see. Yet God's promises were not out of the woods yet. The land was literally swarming with descendants of Abraham, but it was the wrong land. And it was about to get worse before it got any better. Just as God's creational agenda of fruitful multiplication was finally being accomplished through the fruitfulness of the descendants of Abraham, there arose a new king over Egypt with a new agenda that in the context was explicitly anti-creational. In order to understand the plagues that follow, it is crucial to realize that in opposing the multiplying fruitfulness of the descendants of Abraham, Pharaoh and the Pharaoh that followed, because there's actually two Pharaohs in the account, both Pharaohs were pursuing an explicitly anti-creational agenda. The Egyptian leadership, in other words, was setting itself up against Genesis chapter 1. This is not going to turn out good for them. Frightened by the fruitfulness of God's people, he began to oppress them, bringing them into bondage, that is, the Egyptian Pharaoh. He took those who were supposed to be serving the Lord by being a blessing to the nations and forced them to serve him instead, furthering his agenda of oppressing the nations. When oppression alone didn't seem to be working, he tried to undercut the fruitfulness of God's people in progressively more direct ways, ending in a decree to put every male Hebrew child to death. Things were not looking good for the plans and the promises of God at this point. Using a brave mother, a devoted sister, and an unexpectedly compassionate daughter of Pharaoh, God preserved a special child who was given the name of Moses. When his first attempts at delivering his brethren didn't go so well, Moses fled to the land of Midian, where he stayed for 40 long years of continued oppression. And now we'll chapter 2, and we're going to read verses 23 through 25. And it came to pass in the process of time that the king of Egypt died, and the children of Israel sighed by reason of the bondage. And they cried, and their cry came up unto God by reason of the bondage. And God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. And God looked upon the children of Israel, and God had respect unto them. And if you translate that last clause literally, as the King James translators actually note, it's, and God knew. That's what it says, and God knew. God had respect unto them. It was at this point, when all human hope was gone, when the oppression seemed as though it would go on forever, and when the fulfillment of the promises of God seemed more than impossible, that God saw fit to intervene. Though Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob had not done a particularly good job of upholding their end of the covenant God had made with them, God had not forgotten about the promises that He had made. He knew what they were going through, and He was going to do something about it. When Moses, by now an old man, and we're in chapter 3 now, was out in the wilderness tending the flocks of his father-in-law, God appeared to him and commanded him to return to Egypt and bring God's people out from Egyptian bondage. As Egypt was the most powerful country in the world at this time, Moses understandably had a few objections to this proposal. Who, he wanted to know, did God think that he was? Who did God think that Moses was for Moses to be sent on such an audacious and impossible mission? God assured him, "It doesn't matter who you are, it matters who I am, and I am going to be with you." Chapter 3 and verse 12. And he, that is God, said, "Certainly I will be with thee, and this shall be a token unto thee, that I have sent thee, when thou hast brought forth the people out of Egypt. Ye shall serve God upon this mountain." It is here that we pick up on one of the crucial themes of the Exodus account. The problem with the Egyptian bondage was not, as we might think, that God's people lacked independence. The problem, in other words, was not that they were forced to serve when they should have been doing something else, like celebrating parties or having a good time. The problem was not that they had to build buildings. The problem was that they were serving the wrong person and building the wrong sort of buildings. There's a reason, after all, that so much attention is given in the later part of Exodus to the construction of the tabernacle. The construction of the tabernacle is in direct antithesis to the enforced construction of buildings for Pharaoh at the beginning of the book. They go from building storehouses for Pharaoh to building a tabernacle for the presence of the Lord God Almighty. That's a deliberate contrast in the book. This was a people that was already in covenant with God. They were already, as 3:10 points out, my people. It was because they had already been given a job to do by God that the jobs that Pharaoh had forced upon them were so very problematic. The reason it was such a problem that they were serving Pharaoh was because they had already been called and commissioned to serve God, and they were not. Moses wasn't done with his objections when God said that he would be with him. The children of Israel, when he came to them, were going to want to know the name of the God of their fathers. What was he supposed to say? In response, God revealed his divine name to Moses, promising to be and to do everything that was needed to accomplish his promises to his people. Even at this point, he warned Moses that the going was not going to be easy. It was going to take a lot of judgment to undo the anti-creational agenda of Egypt. But in the end, God's plans and purposes would not be defeated. Moses, as most of us know, refused to be satisfied. The people were not going to believe him. God gave him two signs with which to convince them. Moses didn't think he was up for the job. God promised again to be with him. Finally, Moses came right out and refused. When he says, "Send, I pray thee, by the hand of whom thou wilt send," it's saying, "Go find somebody else because I'm not going." It's a direct refusal. And God gave him the ambiguous aid of his brother Aaron. And finally, Moses agreed and headed back to Egypt. It will be in chapter 4, 21 through 23. I'm going to read these verses. "And the Lord said unto Moses," so Moses is now headed back to Egypt with the rod of God in his hand. "And the Lord said unto Moses, when thou goest to return into Egypt, see that thou do all those wonders before Pharaoh which I have put in thine hand, but I will harden his heart, that he shall not let the people go. And thou shalt say unto Pharaoh, thus saith the Lord, Israel is my son, even my firstborn. And I say unto thee, let my son go, that he may serve me. And if thou refuse to let him go, behold, I will slay thy son, even thy firstborn." Now, I mentioned at the beginning tonight that one of those things I've been and will continue to do throughout this course is to focus in each story on those details that will be picked up later in the big story. Though the initial purpose of these words is to set the stage for the climactic 10th plague, this language of firstborn son is language we will hear again in the big story. Israel was God's son, and therefore Israel was supposed to serve God. And though God would be faithful to his promises no matter what, his plans and purposes for creation demanded an obedient son who would serve him. Adam, though he was created in the image, in fact, the Gospel of Luke says that Adam himself was the son of God. He was created in the image and likeness of God, had been a rebellious son that brought destruction to creation instead of fulfillment. God's covenant with Abraham was God's answer to the desolation brought about by the first Adam, and that meant that Israel had the same task that Adam did, to serve God as a faithful son, which they could not do if they were serving Pharaoh. And if Pharaoh stood in the way of God's purposes for his son, it was Pharaoh that was going to suffer. The promises of God would be fulfilled one way or the other. Thus commissioned, Moses returned to the land of Egypt, meeting Aaron along the way. And I'll read up, He went to the children of Israel and brought them God's message. They believed him and they worshipped God. Now only one person stood in the way, Pharaoh, the king of Egypt. Chapter 5, verses 1 and 2. And afterwards, after the people had believed them, Moses and Pharaoh went in and told Pharaoh, "Thus saith the Lord God of Israel, let my people go, that they may hold a feast unto me in the wilderness." And Pharaoh said, "Who is the Lord, that I should obey his voice to let Israel go? I know not the Lord, neither will I let Israel go." Sometimes you ask questions that you really don't want answers to, as bad as you think you do. Pharaoh, by the time this story is done, will have his question answered, but he's going to wish he had never, ever ask it like that. So Moses and Aaron went before Pharaoh and gave them the message. Pharaoh and his pride ask a question that is crucial to the remainder of the Exodus account. Who, Pharaoh wanted to know, was Jehovah? Jehovah, of course, is the word that always lies behind the all caps Lord in the King James, the name that God gave to Moses at the burning bush. Pharaoh had many gods, and in the Egyptian pantheon, the Pharaoh himself was a sort of god. But this Jehovah was not one of them. And he had no intention of letting those he thought of as his servants go. Instead, in chapter 5, he made their bondage even worse by taking away the straw. In despair, Moses went to the Lord and complained that his mission had failed. God had not done what he said that he was going to do. And so God recommissions Moses, chapter 6 and verse 1. Then the Lord said unto Moses, "Now shalt thou see what I will do to Pharaoh, for with a strong hand shall he let them go, and with a strong hand shall he drive them out of his land." And God spake unto Moses and said unto him, "I am the Lord. And I appeared unto Abraham, unto Isaac, and unto Jacob by the name of God Almighty, but my name Jehovah was I not known to them. And I have also established my covenant with them, to give them the land of Canaan, the land of their pilgrimage, wherein they were strangers. And I have also heard the groaning of the children of Israel, whom the Egyptians keep in bondage, and I have remembered my covenant. Wherefore, say unto the children of Israel, I am the Lord, and I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians, and I will rid you out of their bondage, and I will redeem you with a stretched out arm and with great judgments. And I will take you to me for a people, and I will be to you a God, and ye shall know that I am the Lord your God, which bringeth you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. We won't be able to visit every reference to this, but this idea that ye shall know that I am the Lord is crucial to the Exodus account. It's one of the three most central themes to what is going on. Though Moses thought everything was over, he thought, "I went to Pharaoh. Pharaoh didn't believe me, and so now it's all over." But it wasn't over. In fact, it hadn't even begun yet. God's plan had not failed, and it was not time for his messenger to give up. God was going to fulfill his covenant. He was going to accomplish the purposes for which he originally gave that covenant. And though the severity of their bondage, now increased by the initial advent of Moses, did not allow them to see it, deliverance was just around the corner. The anti-creational policies of Egypt were not going to prevail. God's promises were not going to be thwarted. His son Israel was going to know who God was and was going to be freed to serve him. the purpose of the plagues was not simply to judge Pharaoh or to teach him a lesson, though they did that. That was one of their purposes, but also to teach his own people a lesson about the power of God they were supposed to be serving. Not only were the plagues intended to demonstrate to Pharaoh who God was, but to demonstrate to his own people that, after all, had been serving Pharaoh instead of God, just who God was that they were supposed to be serving. We have now come, at the in chapter 7, to the famous 10 plagues of Egypt. Now, it will not be possible in the time that we have tonight to go over each one of them in detail, but I do hope to be able to shed a little bit of light on the purpose and function of the plagues in terms of the larger narrative in which they are found, and some of the ways in which this ties in with the big story as a whole, particularly with what comes before it. Now, up to this point in the Exodus story, God has made a lot of promises. He said, I'm going to deliver my people, but things have, from anything that anyone could see, only gotten worse. Pharaoh was obviously powerful. He was the absolute sovereign of the most powerful country on earth. And Jehovah had had a lot to say, but he hadn't really done much in terms of anything that would unseat the power of Pharaoh. The balance was about to change, and change dramatically. Pharaoh had wanted to know who the Lord was, and he was about to find out. Yet Pharaoh was not the only one who was going to learn from these plagues, as the rest of the text makes clear. The 7:5, and the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord when I stretch forth my hand upon Egypt and bring out the children of Israel from among them. So the promise of the plagues are to answer Pharaoh's question, but we'll see it's going to answer a few other questions as well. So plague one, the first plague, was the turning of the Nile River, and indeed all of the waters of Egypt, into blood, thus making it undrinkable and killing the fish that were in it. Now, in order to understand this plague, it's important not just to read where it says the waters are turned into blood, but also to read verse 18 and verse 24. And the fish that is in the river shall die, and the river shall stink, and the Egyptians shall loathe to drink of the water of the river. And verse 24, after the plague has already taken place. And all the Egyptians digged round about the river for water to drink, for they could not drink of the water of the river. Blood, in Hebrew as in English, can be used metaphorically. And the text clearly indicates that however much the water looked like blood, became undrinkable, and killed the fish that were in it, it still remained, in some sense at least, water, however altered and polluted. It was the water of the river that they couldn't drink of after the water had been turned into blood. This is important because if a river the length of the Nile had actually become chemically transformed into human or animal blood, instead of being the first and lightest of the plagues, as it's clearly presented in the text, Pharaoh sees the water turned into blood, he turns around and goes back to his house. And it's presented as the plagues get increasingly worse. If the Nile River had become human blood or animal blood, it would not have been the lightest of the plagues, but it would have been one of the most devastating things that has happened apart from the Great Flood. And it would have actually we could talk about all of the effects it would have had, but it likely would have led to the extermination of the entire population of Egypt, which didn't have, if you think about the effect that would actually have, that amount of blood in the atmosphere, it would have been utterly devastating, far more so than any of the other plagues. So if you're not convinced by that, I'm not offended, but I do need to move on at this point, and you can ask questions about that later if you have any. If there's something else that is very significant, and that is in verse 19. The word that is translated pools of water, so I'll read 19. And the Lord spake unto Moses, say unto Aaron, take thy rod and stretch out thine hand upon the waters of Egypt, upon their streams, upon the rivers, and upon their ponds, and upon all their pools of water. And the pools of water is the key word here. The word that is translated pools of water is, as the King James translators note, in Hebrew, King James has a cross-reference, and it mentions that the word means this, the same word that is used to refer to the gathering together of the waters in Genesis 1:10. Now, this word is extremely rare in the Hebrew Bible. It only appears three times. It appears here in the Exodus account. It appears in Genesis 1:10 and one other place. And if this was the only parallel between Genesis 1 and Exodus, the plague accounts, then it wouldn't be that significant. But it's not the only parallel, because there are a lot of parallels. And if there are a lot of parallels, that means that most likely most of them, if not all of them, are intentional. It will not. This is the first of the, well, this is a link back to the Genesis account of creation. It will not be the last. Pharaoh did not pay attention to the first plague, so God set another one. Frogs. Lots and lots of frogs. Once again, the word used for the abundant spread of the frogs is a somewhat unusual word that is found in Genesis chapter 1, chapter 1, verse 20. The agenda of the Egyptians was in opposition of God's purposes for creation, and now God is taking from them the benefits of the world that he has made. They hated the order God gave to creation, and now that order is being systematically undone, and the consequences are devastating. The third plague was lice, small blood-sucking insects of some kind. It is interesting that the Genesis account has creatures created in the seas, on the earth, and in the air, and these three locations are paralleled by the second, third, and fourth plagues. The frogs come up out of the water, the lice comes from the dust of the ground, and the flies are buzzing about in the air. The three domains that mankind was supposed to have dominion over are now, as one commentator put it, totally out of control. The fourth plague was flies, which we have already mentioned. It should be noted this was the first plague in which God made distinction between his people and the Egyptians. Up to this point, the plagues, though they had caused a great deal of suffering, had not caused any death. In this plague, plague five, that is a plague on livestock, the service animals, the animals over which, so their cattle, the animals that served the Egyptians had taken dominion over these animals in accordance with the creational mandate of Genesis 1:28, and now those animals were taken away from them. The next plague, plague six, that of boils, is rather strange, and I'm rather less certain of this connection than I am of the other. So the connections to the Genesis account of creation, I think those are rather obvious once you see them. This one is a little less obvious, but I still think it's likely. The Israelites have been oppressed by being forced to make bricks. Now, while bricks in the ancient Near East were often baked in the hot sun, we know that the Egyptians also used kiln-baked bricks. Specifically, they used kiln-baked bricks in the very cities and projects that the text says the Israelites were working on. It is thus quite possibly from these furnaces, because in the Egyptian sun, you would not use a furnace to heat your house. Your house does not need to be heated. So these furnaces are kilns, by which the Egyptians had tried to control the spread of God's people and the accomplishment of his plans, that this plague came upon them. So in this plague, I guess I should have started out with this, Moses takes ashes out of a furnace, and that is how this plague comes about. And so I think it's likely that it's a reference to, that there's not a verbal parallel, it doesn't mention kilns or furnaces earlier in the text, and that's why I'm not certain. But it's very likely, I think, that this furnace was a brick kiln, and if they had been forced to make bricks, and then soot was taken from where the bricks had been made and became boils upon the Egyptians, that would, I think, fit what's going on in the text. Can't be 100% certain of that. Now, while we still have a good deal of ground to cover, we're on plague seven now, so we must hasten on. The next two plagues, that of hail and locusts, work together to destroy the vegetation of Egypt. Again, using language that ties back to the Genesis account of the creation of that vegetation, and we could give the Hebrew words and go into the parallels, but if we did that, I would lose everyone in all the detail, and also we would never go home. So it references back, but if you see a pattern here that the three domains of creation are being undone. So creatures on the earth are become lice. Creatures that are coming out of the water are destroying stuff. Creatures in the air are destroying stuff. And then you have the green grass and the trees and the vegetation are now being destroyed by the hail and the locust. Creation is coming undone. And it's also in the context of the plague of the hail that a crucial statement about the purpose for all of this judgment occurs. I mentioned that the plagues are occurring so that Pharaoh could know that the Lord is God, so that God's people could know that the Lord is God, but there's a broader purpose that is at work in all of this, and we find that in chapter 9 and 16, and this is something that gets picked up in the prophets and is mentioned over and over again. Chapter 9 and 16, and this is addressed to Pharaoh, or it's telling Moses what he's to say to Pharaoh. And in very deed, for this cause have I raised thee up, for to show in thee my power, and that my name may be declared throughout all the earth. That my name may be declared throughout all the earth. All of creation belongs to the Lord, and all of creation needs to know who the Lord is. Even as God was answering, as he said in 7:5, Pharaoh's haughty question about who he was, even as he was demonstrating his nature to his own people, as he said in 6:7, he had not forgotten about the reason he'd called forth a people for his name in the first place. It was to accomplish his purposes for creation. God created all of creation for his glory, and one day that glory, as the prophet Habakkuk said, is going to cover the earth as the waters cover the seas. And this verse is a reminder that God has not forgotten about that greater goal in the midst of all of this very specific judgment. Plague 8 is a locust. I already talked a little bit about that. The ninth plague, that of darkness, also, you knew I was going to say this, didn't you? Ties back to the Genesis account. You see a pattern here. I think there is a pattern here. For not only was there darkness in the land of Egypt, that darkness existed side by side with light in the land of Goshen. So you have darkness over the Egyptians for 3 days, thick darkness that can be touched and felt. And then in the land of Goshen, where you have the children of Israel, you have light for 3 days. And that ties back to Genesis 1:4. And I'll go ahead and actually read this. This is very interesting. Genesis 1:4. You don't have to turn there. But, and God saw the light that it was good, and God divided the light from the darkness. In verse 4, and then in verse 5, and God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. In the evening and the morning were the first day. And God separated light and darkness before he made the light and darkness day and night. And here we have an undoing of the division into day and night, and that darkness is in one place and light is in another. This plague undid the alteration of night and day. Final plague, of course, is the death of the firstborn. The Egyptians had attacked God's firstborn son, the descendants of Abraham, who had been given as a new Adam the task of the first Adam. They oppressed and took away the life of those who bore God's image, and now he was going to take away the life of those who bore their image. Yet though chapter 11 rounds off the section on the plagues with the description of this final judgment, the final and climactic plague is not yet enacted. Instead, as the dramatic tension in the narrative is heightened, the scene shifts to the enactment of the first Passover. And before we move on to this, I want to say one more thing about the meaning and significance of the 10 plagues. Now, as we work through the plagues, I hope that you could see the theme of decreation that seems to be prominent. At least it seems to me to be prominent, and I hope that having worked through at least a few of the details, that you can see what I'm talking about. There are other elements at work, of course, but I think this theme is primary. Now, as I mentioned last week, while I have no sympathy whatsoever for the utter nonsense of the various Bible code books, there is a good deal of evidence for a certain amount of what is referred to as numerical composition in various parts of the Hebrew Bible. While these never, may I repeat it, never give a hidden meaning that is different from the surface meaning of the text, they often function as reinforcements of that surface meaning, providing confirmation that our interpretation of the surface meaning is on the right track. And I could give a lot more caveats, but we need to move on. Now, one of these instances, I think it is almost certain, is present in this account. In the Genesis account, as has often been noted by interpreters of the Hebrew Bible, the exact form of the word that is translated, "and God said," in Hebrew, "Vayomer Elohim," appears exactly 10 times. They're sometimes called the 10 words of creation, or as one commentator put it, the 10 divine utterances by which the world was created and ordered. This is why there were 10 plagues. It was God undoing his work of creating and ordering the creation in response to the anti-creation agenda of the Egyptians. A reference to the 10 words of creation will show up again in our story. And the fact that it shows up again in another context is one of the things that leads me to believe it is actually showing up here. But for now, we must hasten on with the account of the institution of the Passover. Chapter 12. Now, as I mentioned at the beginning, the Exodus story is a central theme that reverberates throughout the remainder of the big story. This reverberation is intentional. It didn't happen by accident. From the very beginning, God established the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread that accompanied it as a means of ensuring that God's people would never forget the deliverance he had wrought from Egyptian bondage. It was to be the centerpiece of their calendar. It was to be a constant occasion for the repetition and the memorization of the Exodus narrative from one generation to the next. While there are many details in the institution of this feast, all of them are significant. The central one, of course, was the blood that was to be painted on the doorpost of the homes of God's people. This blood, the blood on the doorpost, was what marked them off from those who were not his people. Only those who had the blood on the doorpost would be passed over when the destroyer passed through the land to kill the firstborn in God's final judgment on Egypt. Though they could not have understood the details at the time, it would not be the last time that God's people were marked out by blood. It's at this point, on the midnight of the first Passover, that the final plague takes place. Every firstborn in Egypt, both of man and beast, except for those who were protected by blood on the door by blood on the doorpost, died in one night. Pharaoh's heart, hard heart, was finally conquered. And in the middle of the night, the children of Israel finally left their Egyptian bondage, spoiling their erstwhile oppressors as they went. God was serious about his people remembering the Exodus. At the end of chapter 12 and throughout the bulk of chapter 13, God gave additional and reiterated instructions to ensure that both the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread were not forgotten in the future. He was going to use these events as a paradigm in the future, and that would only work if they were not forgotten. And now, after all 10 plagues were completed, the children of Israel finally left the land of Egypt, taking the bones of Joseph with them. Once again, there are many fascinating details we could get into, but we must press on, for there was one more judgment and one more deliverance yet to come. Chapter 14, verses 1 through 4. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Speak unto the children of Israel, that they turn and encamp before Pi-Hahiroth, between Migdol and the sea, over against Baal-Zephon, before it shall ye encamp by the sea. For Pharaoh will say of the children of Israel, They are entangled in the land, the wilderness has shut them in, and I will harden Pharaoh's heart, that he shall follow after them, and I will be honored upon Pharaoh and upon all his hosts, that the Egyptians may know that I am the Lord. And they did so. In desperation at the death of the firstborn, the Egyptians had finally agreed to let the people leave the land. Yet their repentance was only temporary, and their hearts were still hard. Creation had been undone, but they had not given up on their anti-creational agenda. There was only one more step God could take, and when that step was taken, both they and God's own people, without the rest of the nations being forgotten, would know that the Lord was the only God. As the children of Israel encamped by the edge of the sea, Pharaoh and his servants readied their fearsome war chariot and raced toward their newly free slaves. The children of Israel were no longer serving Pharaoh. The brick kilns were cold, and they'd stopped building the treasure cities. But they had not yet begun to serve the Lord. The tabernacle had not yet been built, and they had not yet been to Sinai. They were in a dangerous place of transition, and they knew it. And when they saw the chariot coming, they were terrified and screamed out, It would have been better to die. It would have been better to serve Pharaoh than to die in the wilderness. If the children were not going to die in the wilderness, at least not at the hand of Pharaoh, God was going to fight for them. And he began, as the creation account began, by dividing the waters from the waters with a strong east wind. Once again, there's a strong parallel to the creation account. It's important to know the Hebrew word for spirit is the same word that's translated wind. The word is ruach. It's the same word, spirit, and in wind. The process of recreation had begun. When the ground was dry, God's people began to cross the sea with the pillar of God's presence being a pillar of protection and light on the one side and a pillar of darkness on the other side, keeping the Egyptians from getting too close. So children of Israel moved through the water. The Egyptians, famous for their wisdom in the ancient world, the Egyptians were famous and proverbial for their wisdom, foolishly followed them until they too were in the midst of the waters. And it was then, when the last of God's people had passed through the water, that the waters that had been divided came back together again. The process of decreation, brought on by the anti-creation of Pharaoh and his servants, was complete. If you remember, the creation account begins with the Spirit of God moving upon the face of the waters. That is where it, I'll read Genesis 1, not the whole chapter, but. In the beginning, God created the heaven and earth, and the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. And that appears before the first, when God said, Let there be light, and there was light. So before God said anything, the Spirit of God was moving upon the face of the waters. And that is where the Egyptians have been brought back to. when the ground was dry, it was then, when the last of God's people had passed through the water, that the waters that had been divided came back together again. The process of decreation, brought on by the anti-creation agenda of Pharaoh and his servants, was complete. The Egyptians had returned to the formless waters of Genesis 1-2, as far back as they could get and still be in God's world. As the waters came crashing down upon them, they knew, though it was far too late to apply that knowledge, who Jehovah really was. The same deliverance that brought judgment to God's enemies caused God's own people to trust him. 14:31, and Israel saw that great work which the Lord did upon the Egyptians, and the people feared the Lord and believed the Lord and his servant Moses. They too needed to know who the Lord was, and through the same act of judgment they did. Israel was delivered from Egyptian bondage, just as God had promised. Yet we must not forget the bigger picture. As one commentator put it, God's liberation of Israel is the primary, but not the ultimate focus of the divine activity. The deliverance of Israel is ultimately for the sake of the entire creation. The issue finally is not that God's name be made known in Israel, but that it be declared, as 9:16 says, to the entire earth. God's purposes in these events is creation-wide, for all of the earth is God's. The reason why it was so important for God to rescue this particular group of people is because God had promised to use this particular group of people as the cornerstone of his rescue plan for all of creation. Yet though God had delivered his people from Egyptian bondage, he had not yet brought them into a land of their own, and they had not yet learned to dwell in his presence. They are, as I noted before, no longer servants of Pharaoh, but they are not yet servants of Jehovah, at least not in the sense that God intended for them to be. Decreation has occurred, yet recreation, in accordance with the covenant God had made with Abraham and his descendants, still awaited them. It is that recreation is the people that God had called and commissioned to bring about his good purposes in the world that he made that will be our subject in the next lesson.